I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because all Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia in the Arts Cafe of the Kelly Writers House by Jessica Lowenthal, a teacher and poet, author of As If in Turning, and director of the Kelly Writers House. And by Randall Couch, a poet, critic, administrator, and teacher of poetry and poetics at Arcadia University. And by poet, founder of the Great Bowery Poetry Club in New York, all-out guy Bob Holman, who has been called ringmaster of the spoken word, dean of the scene, poetry czar, and president of the United States of Poetry. Welcome back to my dear pals Randall and Jessica, and hello Bob, Mr. President. And welcome back to Philly, and for the first time to Poem Talk. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Al.
Hi there.
I'd like to call this this congregation to disorder.
There's the president in
We're
action.
Ready to go.
Yeah. Already it starts, guys. Our poem today is Jerome Rothenberg's A Paradise of Poets. You might think that the poem appears in Rothenberg's great book of that title, but no, it's gathered in a book that immediately precedes A Paradise of Poets, the book, a volume called Seedings and Other Poems, published by New Directions in 1996. And I suppose it's possible to conceive of our poem as a kind of implicit preface or working up to that next great book. Penn Sound's Rothenberg page, a treasure trove of readings by this fabulous performer of his own and others' writings, includes a recording made of his April 24th, 1999 appearance on the Radio Reading Project, which was produced by Ernesto Grossman and Roseanne Lamoncelli. And it's there and then that he read our poem. So before we talk, let's have a listen. Here now is Jerome Rothenberg reading A Paradise of Poets.
It's called A Paradise of Poets, and goes back to a sense that I have that that writing poetry for me has always included an involvement with the life of poetry. And through that life, an intensification when it happened of my involvement with the other life around me. I don't, of course, believe that such a paradise of poets exists in any supernatural or mystical sense, but I've sometimes felt it come to life among my fellow poets, and even more in writing, in the body of the poem. So the poem that it goes back to, that the title goes back to, A Paradise of Poets, was in the previous book from New Directions called Seedings. It's a short poem in three short parts. A Paradise of Poets. He takes a book down from his shelf and scribbles across a page of text, I am the final one. This means the world will end when he does. In the Inferno, Dante conceives a paradise of poets and calls it limbo. Foolishly, he thinks his place is elsewhere. Now the time has come to write a poem about a paradise of poets.
Well, who's he here, in the first section at least? Bob, what do you think?
He's a poet. Yeah. Could be a she, of course, you know, but since he does reference Dante, you know, he works, and of course the fact of the matter is that Jerry himself is a he, so we give him that masculine pronoun. But the idea is, I mean, it is kind of funny to take a book down from the shelf and scribbling across a page of text. So the poet is writing on a poem that's already written.
Do you think he's writing over it?
He says he scribbles across a page of text.
That's not what we usually do in books, right? We usually do a marginal thing as a commentary, but he seems to be rewriting it.
Or, yes, gloss, you know, the big gloss.
The gloss that obscures, Randall?
Yeah, I think this is a great gesture of colonization. I love this poem because I think it's a caution to the writers of poetic manifestos.
Wow. You love it because it's a warning against such colonization? We shouldn't rewrite in this way?
I think it explores that subject. Yeah, I think if we unpack the second stanza, I think there's a lot to say about that.
Well, we'll get to the second stanza. I feel myself doing a poem talk in order today. We're still in section one. What's happening to me?
We've been called to disorder.
We've been called to disorder by Bob. You see, he makes trouble. He comes down from New York and makes trouble. Let's go back to what he writes, what he scrawls, what he colonizes with, the statement, I am the final one. What do you take that to mean?
Well, it's the great statement of an ahistorical understanding of poetry. It's teleological. It is the revolution which destroys what precedes it.
Jessica, take a stab at translating that. I am the final. You know, I don't think I agree with Randall,
yeah,
but I love it that he's being so dissident.
I in a way, want to read that more generously. I had that the same sense of it in a way, and then I said, no, maybe this means that each reading of each poem is in itself final and limited, and so my reading of my books dies with me.
So I'm the last one to have done anything with this text. I'm the final one as a reader slash writer.
And the only one to do what I do with this text. This is me. I'm writing on it. My book, my text, my reading.
He takes a book down from his shelf and scribbles across a page of text, I am the final one. This means the world will end when he does.
I'm reminded of Ted Berrigan's introductory poem to one of his books that was dedicated to the poets of the future. Remember, I wrote these poems, not you. And I think there you have every poet thinking of herself as the final one. You know, I have the final say because I wrote it. And in that way, and this is where we get into the intriguing aspect of community here with the paradise of poets. Each poet writes the individual voice, and yet each one is writing on the books or shoulders.
So can it be as solipsistic a gesture as that? This means the world will end when he does, and still be generous in tone or spirit, as Jessica seems to suggest? Randall thinks so, yes.
I think it's a very generous poem in its totality, but I think that the he of the first stanza is an object lesson in the opposite.
Okay.
I think he works back around to this.
So for you, it's possibly dialogical or it's possibly
exactly
progressive. Can you give us a hint of where you think it's going? Because you have an idea, I know.
If we take a look at the second stanza, I think I can do that.
In the Inferno, Dante conceives a paradise of poets and calls it limbo. Foolishly, he thinks his place is elsewhere.
Okay, then, take two. Dante's here. The poem's title appears now. And then a statement by a speaker about him. Foolishly, he thinks his place is elsewhere. Go ahead, Randall.
Well, Rothenberg is one of our most sophisticated readers of poetries of many cultures and over history. And so he wouldn't make the beginner's mistake of taking the Inferno out of the context of the entire poem. So the statement as written is a little nonsensical. Most of the poets in the Divine Comedy are in the Purgatorio, and particularly two, the great Provençal troubadour Arnaud Daniel and Dante's immediate predecessor Guido Guinizelli. And you'll remember that Dante calls Arnaud the il miglior fabbro, the greater or the greatest maker. And of Guinizelli, he says that your sweet lines, so long as modern usage lasts, will still make dear uh-huh their very inks. And so he's talking about lineage. And even though his character in the poem is very expresses humility, by its structure, he puts himself as, to steal a phrase from the Jefferson Airplane, the crown of poetic creation. So he's writing his name across the history of poetry by separating those poets, the modern poets, from the classical poets in limbo, which is the paradise of the virtuous pagans. Now, I don't think Rothenberg's interested in the theological structure, but I read this as him saying that it's a mistake for anyone to be so historically naive as to conceive that poetry is not a community across time and across cultures, and that he should not be separating them in this way.
Well, thank you for that. What do the rest of us think about the statement then that he would think his place is elsewhere, and that is wrong. What does elsewhere mean?
I was actually really surprised by this section because I actually didn't quite... I didn't know what we were supposed to relate. I didn't know that if is this he Dante, is this he the reader from section one. I mean, I assume it's Dante.
Well, it could be Dante, and it could also be the poet of the first section.
But the paradise of poets itself that is called limbo, that in itself also confuses me. I think I like Randall's explanation. It makes it make more sense because I thought Dante wasn't interested in a paradise of poets, right? This is first circle of hell right here.
Well, let's just talk generally about what poets over time have thought a paradise might be. Maybe Bob's the right one to ask since you've created a paradise of poets on the Bowery.
Indeed.
Well, oh, hooray, yes. The Bowery Poetry Club would step up as both being a paradise and definitely some of the circles of hell. but, you know, the title here, you know, the title is one of these collective noun names, right? You got a gaggle of geese, you've got a school of fish, you've got a murder of ravens, and you've got a paradise of poets. You see,
Bob, if someone were to come in and say and look around at such a place that you've created and call it limbo, it's either funny, a horrible criticism of all the work you've put into it, or strangely accurate. If it's the last, what could that person mean?
Well, limbo, you're waiting, right? And I guess the paradise of poets is waiting to go in one direction or the other.
So elsewhere would be the op. If elsewhere is a place that's not waiting, limbo, as Bob says, just logically speaking, how would we characterize that elsewhere?
Elsewhere, I think, for Rothenberg, as I understood his headnote to this poem as he was describing it, elsewhere isn't actually a place. It's a way of living in relation or writing in relation to other poets. It's about assemblage, collection, reading, writing across, writing through, collage, following. And so it's
so
elsewhere
interacting,
is,
poets interacting with each other and their texts. And Randall, if I may, Jerry says in introducing this poem, I don't, of course, believe that such a paradise exists in a supernatural or mystical sense, but I've sometimes felt it come alive in my fellow poets and even more in writing. And we can amend that to say, in their writing do I find the fellowship and community that of the sort that sparks a Bob Pullman to create a Bowery Poetry Club. It's in the writing, it's in the people and their social fellowship, but it's in the writing, and then he says, in the body of the poem. Randall?
Now the time has come.
Moving along to part three.
Part three. This is exactly where I think he's going with this poem, is that now is the time to write a poem about a paradise of poets, and I think by write a poem here, he means create a poetic community. It's a figure. It's a time for a new poem of the makers that has a more inclusive and anthropological understanding of diversity rather than such a competitive one, is the way I read this.
And it's possible, and maybe I'm not saying
it's
the same thing.
It's happening on the Bowery.
But I mean, it's possible that that new kind of being a poet is inclusive at the level of the poem itself. I think that's what you were saying. It's not quite that a group will come in at 6 p.m. into this space and do their reading, and they will all shuffle out, and the group coming in at 8 o'clock will then come in. That's a kind of diversity. It's creating our poetic spaces so that they include all kinds of people across the poetic spectrum. But I think Jerry is fantasizing of a paradise in which the 6 o'clock group and the 8 o'clock group are together in the same space at the same time, and they're writing the poem of the present.
And that the writers of one inclination can respect and use the products of writers of other inclinations rather than writing across their texts.
Which has been the dynamic that has been Rothenberg's life.
Yes.
You know, Allen Ginsberg once said to me that he thought that Jerry has saved us all 20 years. In other words, pre-Google. Jerry was Google. You know, he went out and did the work to create the ethnopoetics, to dig into the technicians of the sacred, and to shake the pumpkin, to find the works of our oral poets. fit onto a page. Likewise, he continues now with his poems for the millennium of stacking up all the poets from the before the beginning of time to have this community exist under the covers. So
anthropology, literary anthropology, that's a traditional anthropology of gathering, collecting, and anthologizing, but also a kind of anthropology at the level of language, learning from the pumpkins being shaken, you know, learning how the line changes.
And that's how this becomes a generous poem.
He takes a book down from his shelf and scribbles across a page of text, "I am the final one." This means the world will end when he does. In the Inferno, Dante conceives a paradise of poets and calls it limbo. Foolishly, he thinks his place is elsewhere. Now the time has come to write a poem about a paradise of poets.
Does anyone feel there's something elegiac in that mode, though? I mean, I hear that we're saying that that's celebratory, that's giving to all of us as readers, as poets, but that this becomes the first, the title for a book that has a lot of elegy in it. And this line as the ending line, now the time has come to write a poem about a paradise of poets, it feels to me like a heavy gesture. So I feel like I started opposite Randall and am ending opposite Randall.
I think Randall is saying, and he's here and can speak for himself, now is the time for all good men and women to come to the aid of the party of poetry. Now is the time. It's a real declarative gesture. That's different from what you're saying. You're hearing wistfulness.
I am.
Almost an irony. That is to say, now is the time to write a poem, but...
Wasn't it already the time for
that? Our time has passed. Yeah. What do you think, Bob?
Jerry,
who's right here?
I think everybody's right as usual. You know, in Jerry's own voice, you'll always hear that wistfulness. You'll always hear Poland 1931 where whenever Jerry is reading. You'll hear this biblical sense of language as heavy. You know, he's always got a heavy breath. And yet, meaning-wise here, where are we? At the end of the poem? Absolutely at the beginning. Now it's the time to write a poem, a paradise of poets. Too bad, I just finished writing it. It's done. We've talked for half an hour about it to make sure that it's done.
So are you saying, Bob Holman, that the poem that's referred to in the third section is the kind of poem that includes this poem itself?
I'm saying it is this poem itself.
Now the time has come to write a poem about a paradise of poets. I'm doing it now.
The title of the poem has to be A Paradise of Poets.
And again, he says in his introduction, I felt it come alive, this sense, in the writing. And I guess we could amend that, given what Bob just said, to in the act of writing. The writing is the making of the paradise.
The word now really helps us get there, too. Now, now.
And now is the now of reading now. And the now of writing. And, of course, it collapses, as you've observed earlier, it collapses the distinction in the first section between the writer and the reader. Readers have a writerly feel here. Well, before we get to the Gathering Paradise segment of our show, let me ask each of you to offer a final word on this poem, if there's anything else left to say, or maybe something more on what you get from it. Bob, you want to start?
The cyclical nature of the poem, you know, the Ouroboros, the infinite continuation, the eternal beginning. You know, that you end the poem, A Paradise of Poets, by saying, now the time has come to write a poem about a paradise of poets. And here we go again.
I am the final one.
Good luck.
There is no final one.
Randall Couch.
I would just say that I don't think some sense of elegy is inconsistent with the readings that we've proposed in the recognition by an ethnographer, an anthropologist, that there are so many poems in the history that and poets that are no longer there that we can prize.
Does the poem, I'm going to ask you an elemental question, does the poem make you a little sad and wistful, or does it make you want to go leave this room and be part of a paradise of poets?
It makes me think the farmer and the cowman should be friends.
And that is very nearly a final word, except that Jessica has something to say, too.
I can answer that question, I guess. I think that last line is, in many ways, a proposition to anyone reading the poem to write that poem if it isn't this poem. As a reader, it becomes this poem. As a writer, it might be your own paradise of poets poem.
Thank you, Jessica. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of gathering paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands, to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail, puff up, commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Jessica, can you gather some paradise for us?
Yes. I want to put in a plug for great book design and young book designers, particularly who are working outside the commercial press markets. There's a poet named Jeff Clark, whose design shop is called K. Madurak. He does covers for all kinds of presses, small presses, bigger trade houses, Wesleyan, Wake Forest University, Wave Books, Flood Editions. And I'll just read what he says about some of his designs. I want to communicate that a book cover isn't just like a television screen made out of paper. It's the surface of something. Yet paradoxically, it's the thing itself, the skin around the skull, not just a piece of advertising put on top of the book. You should definitely check out the press shop. It's QUEMADURA.net.
Thank you, Jessica. Bob, gather some paradise. Speaking of paradise.
Yeah, well, I got to talk about the Bowery Poetry Club.
I'm glad you
brought it. BoweryPoetry.com, where the bartenders are poets, and they stand on the bar and read their poems, and they will sell you an Allen Ginsberg or a Gertrude wine, if you insist. And they'll also,
as I often insist,
they'll also sell you a book called The Bowery Bartender's Big Book of Poems, so that besides being a club that everybody belongs to, and besides having as our slogan, "What the hell is going on here?" You also can actually help some artists pay the rent by coming to the Bowery between Bleecker and Houston, across the street from CBGB's, we like to say, although elegiacally there is no CBGB's, it'll still be there for us. Drop by, have a beer, get up on the stage and kick a poem. It's a paradise of poets.
Thank you, Bob. It certainly is. And that's all the poetic bartenders we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Randall Couch, Jessica Lowenthal, and Bob Holman, and to my co-producer, Mark Lindsay, and Poem Talk's director and editor, Steve McLaughlin. A shout out to Hal Sirowitz. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.